Chapter 68. The world was changing, and the source of the change was America. In another time, such flagrant and obvious corruptions of the normal passage of things would have brought the Cronus Club tumbling down on their creator's head like the walls of Babylon atop a heretical priest. But the clubs were not only weakened, but in this life, the second since the massed forgettings inflicted on its members, hundreds of members were coming into an awareness of who and what they were, as though for the very first time. Previously, the clubs had had to process one new member each every century or so, but in this new world, the survivors were swamped. "We could do with your help, Harry," Akinlaye said. Remarkable Akinlaye, who had chosen to forget, and who, through luck more than anything else, had managed to escape Vincent's clutches when he came after us all, was taking charge. Aged 16 years old, she was juggling duties in London, Paris, Naples, and Algiers, marshalling survivors and caring for the newcomers, only just beginning to learn what they were. "I've got Kalachakra kids committing suicide. I've got kids in mental institutions. Adults getting God. Adults not understanding why they shouldn't kill Hitler. And, Harry, I've only been doing this for 4 lives that I can remember myself. You're one of the lucky few who hasn't lost control. Help me." Akinlaye, the only Kalachakra who knew the truth, knew that Vincent hadn't wiped my memory. I didn't dare tell anyone else. "I think the one who did this is still out there," I replied. "If I can't find him, he'll only come after the clubs again."
"There's time for revenge later, isn't there?"
"Maybe, but maybe not. Time has always been our problem in the Cronus clubs. Always had so much. Never learned to appreciate it." I left her to struggle on and flew to America in 1947, an expert in strategic deception, a scholar of Mediterranean corsairs in the 1720s, a press pass in my wallet for a minor British newspaper looking to expand its focus, and my eyes firmly set on Vincent Rankis, wherever he might be. Wherever he was certainly busy. Colour TVs were already on sale, and scientists were wondering how long it would be before man walked on the moon. Clearly sooner, their enthusiasm seemed to imply, than I was used to. It was a country in boom, the fervour of those who'd lived through the war combining with an overwhelming sense that this time America hadn't simply won, it was the victor, unstoppable, undefeatable, a country that had fought on 2 fronts and on both fronts had proved itself superior. The nuclear age was upon us, and it seemed only a matter of time before everyone wore tight-fitting suits and flew to work with a rocket pack. The Soviet menace was a gathering storm on the horizon, but damn it, good Americans would triumph over the tiny minority of bad Americans, who were swayed by this doctrine of evil, as good Americans had triumphed so powerfully before. I had lived a long time in America, in lives gone by, but hadn't before crossed the waters so soon after the Second World War. The civil rights movement, Vietnam, Watergate, these were all to come, and now I was somewhat overwhelmed by the warmth of my welcome, the hearty greetings and genuine praise I received, even for such trivial achievements as walking into a drugstore and buying a toothbrush. "An excellent choice of toothbrush, sir." And the many admonitions to buy household goods, which should not, quite simply, should not have been. Watching the colour TV in my hotel room, I wondered if Senator McCarthy would do so well in this new world, now the vivid flushes of his skin could be seen in such glorious technicolour. Black and white, I concluded, lent a certain dignity to proceedings that the proceedings themselves probably lacked. As luck would have it, I was not the only one who had noticed America's remarkable technological breakthroughs. Even linear journalists were printing headlines like, "America Does It Again," praising some out-of-the-blue discovery. Magazines hailed the years 1945 to 50 as the epoch of invention, distressing both the Aruberan and pedant inside me, while Eisenhower went on TV to warn not only against the burgeoning military-industrial complex, but the loss of American values which this new era of steel, copper, and wireless technology might bring. By 1953, street lighting was going halogen, Valium was the antidepressant of choice, and we were all being invited to trade in our clunky, unfashionable glasses for soft contact lenses guaranteed to bring the sparkle back into the corner of your eye. I watched, amazed by the cartoonish quality of it all, as the society of 1953 processed the technology of 1960 with both a ravenous hunger and a slight hesitation, as if the generations who were set to rebel weren't quite sure yet what it was they were meant to rebel against. The most infuriating part of all this was tracing the source of the outbreak. Inventions weren't springing out of one company or one place, but from dozens of companies and campuses across the country, all of which then engaged in bitter patent rows with each other, while the technology spread virus-like from mind to mind, unstoppable, uncontainable, out of control. I spent nearly 2 years trying to pin down where these remarkable ideas were springing from, growing ever more infuriated by the stonewalling and empty shrugs I received from my inquiries, even as teams of scientists set to work taking the basic principles behind mundane devices and extrapolating them into something entirely new, entirely their own work, and far, far too advanced for the time of their invention. Perhaps more alarming, for every new device the Americans came up with, the Soviets would send more agents to steal it and push their own people harder to find the answers for themselves, and so the technology race accelerated. It took a doctor of chemistry at MIT, one Adam Schofield, to finally give me the answer I needed. We'd met at a talk on innovation, experimentation, and the new age. We had a drink afterwards in a hotel bar and talked about bad cars, good books, disappointing sportsmen, and the upcoming presidential race, before finally getting onto the subject of the day's latest developments in biomass energy. "You know what, Harry," he explained, leaning in close of the embarrassingly empty bottle of port we'd been sharing. "I feel like such a liar when I take credit for that." "Indeed, but why, Dr. Schofield?" "I understand it. I can explain it. We could do fucking amazing things with it. Amazing things, Harry. I mean, paradigm-shifting amazing. But the actual idea? I tell people it came to me in my sleep. Can you believe that crap? What a load of bull." "Oh, but no, Dr. Schofield. Surely not, Dr. Schofield. But then, where did your ideas come from?" "Some letter in the post. 5 sides of fucking science like you would not believe, like you've never fucking seen. Took me 4 days before I got it, and I was sat looking at it, and, Harry, this letter, this guy, whoever sent it, it was the mother lode."
"Did he know who he was?"
"No, he did not, but..."
"Do you still have this letter?"
"Sure, kept in a drawer. I've always been open about this to anyone who asked, because I sure as hell don't want to get sued if this guy ever comes after me or something. But the faculty, they wanted it done real quiet."
So here it was. Here was the big moment. "Can I see it?" He had, as promised, kept it in a drawer, in an envelope marked Dr. A. Schofield. His office was an attempt at wood-panelled antiquity that the building could not sustain. The light on the desk was low, covered with a green shade. I sat and read through the 5 pieces of double-sided thick yellowish paper on which were scrawled a series of diagrams, numbers and equations which would be in first-year chemistry classes across universities everywhere in 1991. We Kalachakra can change a lot about ourselves, but oddly enough, we rarely consider changing our handwriting, and Vincent's headlong scrawl was recognisable anywhere. I examined the paper, looked for a watermark, found none. Examined the ink, the envelope for anything. Anything at all which might suggest a point of origin. Nothing. I was many, many years too late. I tried to work out how old Vincent would be now, mid-20s at a pinch, able to blend into any campus in any college in the US. Then again, if this was his method of accelerating technological development by stimulating the minds of those at its present-day forefront, perhaps he'd struck again elsewhere. Harvard? Berkeley? Caltech? It took persuasion, and on more than one occasion, copious amounts of rather pricey alcohol. But there they were. Letters on yellow paper several years old. In 1 or 2 faculties, the professors who received the documents had ignored them, treated them as pranks. Now, as they watched their rivals forge ahead in the field, they kicked themselves and drank a little deeper of their academic sorrows. But Vincent's method was still only a means to an end. He wished to accelerate modern technology, to reach a point where he could recommence his work, find his answers, and build his quantum mirror, presumably using technology from some time in the early 21st century. I knew now how he was going to achieve this, but I was far too late to the chase to be able to prevent the dissemination of technology which he had begun. Now I needed to discover where the next step was happening, for there Vincent would be. And all the while, As I searched, the technology moved on with frightening speed. In 1959, the first personal computer, rather optimistically dubbed the future machine by an inventor so dazzled with his own brilliance he couldn't think of anything better, was on sale. It was the size of a small wardrobe and had a life of approximately 4 months before the internal parts melted under the strain. But it was, nevertheless, a sign of things to come. If I'd been less preoccupied with finding Vincent, I might have appreciated the role technology was playing in politics a little further. I'd never noticed Israel invade Syria and Jordan before, although I was hardly surprised when furious local resistance drove even the technologically superior IDF back to more defensible borders. The declaration of holy war in the Middle East toppled the Iranian Shah several years earlier than average, but secular strongmen seemed to be the power of the moment, leaping into the vacuum left behind with a new generation of military equipment that put the 1980s to shame. Armies tend to exploit science faster than civilians, if only because their needs tend to be more urgent. By 1964, the Soviets were winding up the Warsaw Pact, and the US declared another great triumph for capitalism, consumerism, and commerce. And still, technology surged and surged ahead. I'd got myself a position as science editor on a magazine based in Washington, D.C., in which capacity I also quietly reported to the FBI on the developing crimes of the age, including telephone fraud and the world's first ever computer hack, dated 1965. Had my editor ever learned of my duplicity, I would probably have been sacked on principle and rehired for the quality of my scoops and the quirky range of my contacts. All this I watched with an apparently disinterested awareness, even as the Cronus Club seethed and raged about me. The future was being destroyed before our very eyes, the effects of the 20th century rippling forward through time. Billions of lives were going to be changed, and possibly billions of Kalachakra no longer born, or their worlds torn beyond all recognition. We, the children of the 20th century, were doing this as blithe and oblivious as a whale to the writhing of plankton in the sea.
Harry, we have to do something.
Akinlaye.
Too late. How did this happen?
Some letters were sent with some bright ideas in them. That's all.
There has to be something.
Too late, Akinlaye. Much, much too late. Find Vincent. That was all there was. Forget consequences. Forget time. Find Vincent. I scoured every technology company, every university, interrogated every contact, investigated every rumour and leak. I trawled through shipping manifests in search of the components which I knew would be on anyone's shopping list for a quantum mirror, investigated every scientist and scholar who might be of service to Vincent, who had the appropriate knowledge, and all the time quietly wrote articles on the changing world and the prowess of American technological development. I was careful, too. I operated behind a great range of guises, very rarely revealing my true identity when investigating a story. If I wrote an article on agricultural fertilizers in Arizona, then I would be Harry August. But if a man phoned a nuclear scientist in the night to ask about the latest developments in electron microscopes, he did so under any name and with any voice that was not mine. By Vincent's reckoning, I should have forgotten all my past lives, save the one immediately after my forgetting, and this existence should only be my second on the earth. If I were to stumble on Vincent through my research, it had to appear by chance, not intent. My perceived ignorance and weakness were my greatest weapons, to be cherished for a final blow. And then, without warning, there he was. I was attending a talk on nuclear technology in the age of the extra-atmospheric long-range missile, which my editor hoped I'd write up under the tagline, "Missiles in Space." I found the idea rather unprofessional, as it implied a multiple exclamation mark at the end of the title and possibly an opening paragraph beginning, "There are some ideas too terrible," before swelling to an oratorical climax. A card, delivered to my hotel door, invited me to discuss these issues further with the sponsor of this event, a Mrs. Evelina Cynthia Wright, who had added in a personal note at the end of the invite how terribly pleased she was to see the media taking an interest in these dire affairs. With a sense of disappointment already well settled in my bones, I drove out to her house, a great white-walled mansion some 3 miles from the Louisiana River. The evening was damp, hot, and chittering. The vegetation around the sprawling, overgrown estate hung down like it too could no longer bear the heat, while an air conditioning system, straight off the manufacturing line, was blasting out steamy clouds from a device the size of a small truck, wedged up against one side of the otherwise venerable property, like a technological leech on a historical monument. By the cars lined up around an entirely algae-covered pond, it was clear I was not the only guest, and a maid answered the door even before I could knock, inviting me to take an iced julep, a business card, and handmade peppermint for my pains. The sound of polite conversation and, less polite, child-made music drifted out of what I could only call the ballroom, a great high-ceilinged place with wide windows that opened onto the rear garden, an even more excessively drooping jungle than at the front of the house. The music was being produced by a would-be torturer aged 7 1/2 and her violin of pain. Proud family and polite friends were sat in a small circle before the child, admiring her stamina. As if to prove that this at least was inexhaustible, she began in on another medley. Over 800 years of reasonable living had rather dented my adoration for the works of the young. Surely I could not be the only creature on this earth who favoured prolonged incubation as a safer method of development than puberty. Mrs. Evelina Cynthia Wright was exactly what a grand dame of the Louisiana River should have been, extremely courteous, utterly welcoming, and as hard as the rusted nails which bound her great property together. Her research was clearly as up to date as her rather ineffective air conditioning unit, for, as I stood scanning the room, considering whether I had made enough of a necessary token appearance, and wondering, not for the first time, if journalism was an appropriate response to the encroaching end of the world, she bore down on me like a melting glacier, and cried out,
"I say, Mr. August!"
I managed to suppress my flinch and crank up my smile, producing a half-bow to the hand offered to me by the wrist. Even fingers, it seemed, drooped in this weather.
"Mr. August, it's so good of you to come. I've been such an avid follower of your work."
"Thank you for the invitation, Mrs. Wright."
"Oh, my! You're British? Isn't that charming? Darling?"
A man, three parts moustache to one part facial features, responded to "darling" with the dutiful twitch of one who has chosen not to fight the inevitable.
"Mr. August is British. Would you ever have guessed?"
"No, ma'am."
"I've read so many of your articles, but then I imagine writing in the American way must just come naturally to you."
"Had it? Was I permitted to say so? Was this a gathering where all modesty was false, all boasting insufferable? Where, I wondered, did speedy social victory and hasty escape lie?"
"You absolutely have to meet Simon. Simon is such a dear and has been dying to meet you. Oh, Simon!"
I fixed my smile in the locked position, and upon reflection, that was probably what saved the situation. The man called Simon turned. He too was sporting a moustache that rolled out from his top lip like a crashing brown wave, and a smaller goatee, which ever so slightly misdirected the user's eye to his left collarbone. He held an icy glass in one hand and a rolled-up copy of the magazine I worked for in the other, as if about to swat a fly with it, and there were plenty of candidates for the honour. Seeing me, he opened his mouth in an expansive "oh" of surprise, for this was a gathering where nothing short of expansive would do, tucked the magazine under his arm, wiped his hand off on his shirt, perhaps to remove the detritus of perished flying adversaries, and exclaimed,
"Mr. August, I've been waiting so long to meet you."
His name was Simon. His name was Vincent Rankis.